don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. All right, guys, welcome to another Cryptoconomy Quick Read. I'm going to actually read another one of my own articles today. This one is titled Seven Misunderstandings of Bitcoin's Scaling Problem. Now, I know for anybody who's been around for quite a while, the scaling debate is probably getting really old and worn out, but there are enough new people that I think have mostly just accepted the argument one way or the other without ever digging really deep into the debate itself. So without further ado, let's just go ahead and jump into the article and we'll discuss it afterward. Again, this one is titled Seven Misunderstandings of Bitcoin's Scaling Problem, and it was written by myself, and you can find it on my Medium page at The Cryptoconomy. I did, for quite some time, fail to see the real scaling hurdle that faces Bitcoin. It was all about the block size and how many transactions we could get on chain. Block size just jumps out at you before anything else as the obvious and most direct corollary to how much we can accomplish with the blockchain. So how could someone argue that such a thing may be one of the least important parameters for Bitcoin's success? Being a very early adopter of this technology, I've gotten used to it operating a certain way. I've become comfortable with what a transaction is, how long I have to wait, and am generally familiar with all of the software and means of interaction. Someone coming along and saying that my interaction with it is going to have to change throws up a red flag for me. And it did when I first heard the suggestion that blocks should be kept small. How the hell am I supposed to buy stuff on Newegg or Amazon if transaction fees are high? Bitcoin becomes unusable, doesn't it? So whenever I get worried, nervous, or unsure of what comes next, I read. I consume anything and everything I can get my digital hands on. I promise you, I have consumed and assessed nearly every possible argument for and against a block size increase, as is easily discoverable on the internet. And after hundreds of nuanced, fascinating, heavy-handed, belligerent, thought-provoking, or outright idiotic arguments, I have firmly come down on the side of keeping the block size as small as we can manage. Now, before you get angry and start deciding the reasons why I'm stupid or which bank is funding my article, just hear me out. During my journey from infinite block size to maybe we can get away with no direct block size increase at all, I went through a series of critical realizations. Here they are. 1. What size block solves high fees? When diving into this debate, you will inevitably run into the comparison to transactions per second handled by Visa. Seems very logical at first. People shop and make transactions the same way they always have at a predictable, albeit increasing, rate. You buy a magazine, you go out shopping, you get gas, and you buy your morning coffee. These are the normal situations where a transaction occurs, and Bitcoin, if successful, would have to handle all of that activity by some method. The obvious conclusion would be that we need a block size that can accommodate transactions for every individual who wants to use it, right? Here's where something was nagging at me. Think about just the handful of revolutionary use cases Bitcoin can deliver at this extremely early stage. Development teams are, at this very moment, building decentralized cryptocurrency exchanges, Internet of Things networks for devices to trade and share resources, smart contract ownership models, trustless gambling and prediction networks, social media with built-in selling and tipping, and networks for exchanging computational resources in real time. These are only the first and most obvious use cases for the Bitcoin technology. We are still probably a decade away from the Google, Amazon, and Facebook game changers in the development timeline. From that perspective, Using Visa as a barometer for transactions is analogous to predicting today's email traffic by counting the number of faxes sent in the 80s. We're talking millions or billions of transactions, not thousands. If Bitcoin is to be the revolution it promises to be, we're talking about scaling to orders of magnitude higher throughput than even Visa. There is no feasible way to create a widely distributed, agile, and censorship-resistant network where every single node has to store the entire history of this enormous transaction potential. No sustainable block size will ever accommodate every user's transactions on chain, and certainly not while requiring only a 1 cent fee to do so. Even Visa, with massive central servers, charges the merchants a 20 to 50 cent fee per transaction. The scaling problem is an exponential one, and simply cannot be solved with a linear solution. A 100 megabyte block size is not a drop in the bucket of the scaling problem, it's a drop in the ocean. 2. Is there any way to safely get 1000x capacity? As I hope I illustrated with number 1, our scaling challenge is not trivial. If a bigger block size is our only hope of accommodating this scale, then we already lost. The only way Bitcoin can be a universal and widely used currency if we can build secure layers on top of it. If we can get 1000x the capacity right now through layered protocols like Lightning and sidechains without any consensus-breaking block size increase, then there is hope that a decentralized currency and payment system is possible on a single highly layered chain. But if we can only get 2 to 3x, then raising the block size is just delaying the obvious truth that this technology can't scale to a global high-speed payment system while sustaining independence and decentralization. If that is the case, I say a small censorship-resistant network providing a secure monetary backbone to traditional services solves a far more difficult and historically significant problem, and therefore is vastly more valuable than yet another PayPal that merely replaces the merchant paying the transaction fee with the consumer paying the fee. 3. Are Lightning and sidechains just another trade-off? In their dogmatism for larger blocks, many, quote, hard forkers have foolishly taken to fundamentally attacking some of the most exciting innovations in the cryptocurrency space. Sidechains and layered solutions like Lightning Network are highly desirable, regardless of their scaling advantages. The true promise of these layers are new features, instant and cheap transactions, and advanced smart contracts. If we want distributed business models and complex agreements enforced by the blockchain, then we need specifically designed sidechains and layered protocols that take advantage of the underlying security of Bitcoin and extend it to a unique set of rules or network topologies. I'm often led to believe by some hard fork supporters that the handful of core developers associated with Blockstream are in opposition to larger blocks simply and only because it would somehow eliminate the use of sidechains or layered scaling like the Lightning Network, aka make Blockstream development work unnecessary. I find this claim rather absurd with even a rudimentary exploration of Bitcoin's scaling problem or a brief examination of the potential of layered protocols in sidechains. 4. Is the Bitcoin blockchain really a better payment network? As I explored in my previous article, Bitcoin is valued for fast and cheap payments. Bitcoin still has some major hurdles to overcome as a payment network. And I asked the critical question of what Bitcoin's value proposition really is. What I have slowly come to realize is that Bitcoin is a rather poor payment network, but it is a revolutionary breakthrough as an arbiter. Bitcoin transactions, even at the very beginning, have always been unreliable and slow in comparison to a credit card or PayPal transaction. See the above article for a personal recount. Even very early on, when fees were just 5 cents, it has always been more expensive for the user than nearly every major centralized alternative. On-chain transactions have never been well-suited for in-store purchases and only work reasonably well for online purchases. On the other hand, as a dispute arbiter, The Bitcoin blockchain represents a veritable revolution compared with current alternatives. So far, no institution in the world has been capable of challenging the outcome of a contract or transaction executed on the Bitcoin blockchain. For any system that can be adapted to a programmable contract, essentially all business or trade contracts could eventually be enforced this way. There is no service-based immutability, trust, or independence that can come close to matching what is achieved by a global and decentralized blockchain. However, its security is entirely dependent on the resiliency and distribution of the rule-enforcing nodes, which leads me to my next realization. 5. Bitcoin's resilience is dependent upon the distribution of validators. If miners were the only players who secured Bitcoin consensus, as some believe, Bitcoin would be no significant improvement over the legacy banking system. Basic peers would hold no power over the monetary rules that they followed. All value in consensus would be with a very small group of highly visible and well-funded participants. Currently, 6 mining institutions represent the hashing majority, nearly 60% of the network. According to those who think consensus is achieved and secured through mining power alone, the entire security of the Bitcoin network rests with 6 companies. In my opinion, such a system would be as arbitrary as the Federal Reserve, easily controlled, and could in no way be considered decentralized. The reality is that a large part of Bitcoin's consensus is more akin to a pre-established relationship between miners and validators. Nodes establish which is the valid chain, and miner incentives work to extend the chain that has the most economic reward, i.e., whichever is most valuable. The Bitcoin Cash fork is an excellent experiment that proved these principles in practice. Constant shifts in mining profitability, thanks to the EDA, or emergency difficulty adjustment, resulted in immediate correlating shifts in the hash power. If a majority of nodes and economic players stake a claim to a specific rule set, all they have to do is wait, as those rules allow a substantial reward to any miner who creates new blocks while adhering to them. What we've witnessed with this technology is that the degree of mining power working with nodes only affects the frequency of new blocks in the short term, the difficulty adjustment in the midterm, and has very little long-term effect. If miners change their rules, they simply create a separate ledger, which all full nodes will ignore by default, unless they also specifically alter their software to match it. To put it simply, a Bitcoin miner cannot decide which network is more valuable any more than a miner of precious metals decides which one will have a higher market price. 6. Is large block latency and resource cost really negligible? What many don't realize, unless you look very closely at the current Bitcoin network, is that 1 megabyte blocks are already resulting in security trade-offs that begin to compromise the robustness of the validation process. Right now, many large miners use direct channels and rely only on the block header as a means of accepting valid blocks. Because of just 1 megabyte of data, miners compromise validation, albeit in a seemingly minor way, in favor of expediency and begin mining the next block before validating the previous one. This already puts large institutional miners at an advantage if they can communicate directly with other large players. In this way, they both get a head start from faster relay and don't have to perform a full validation of new blocks. Now, maybe this is only a 1% cost advantage, maybe it's 5%, but every single time we raise the network resource costs, the gap is worsened. Walmart may only have a few percent advantage in their economy of scale distribution, but that small advantage puts tens of thousands of competitors out of business. An agile network with low resource costs, with 1 million validators across the globe, incontestably securing the network's monetary principles, and with quickly deployable nodes, is one that could isolate the manipulation of money for political gain to the pages of history. A network where nodes require significant resource costs, where nodes are inconvenient and slow to deploy, and where miners are considered the only important enforcers will give no significant resistance to the political desire to control the world's money. And worse, it still won't have low fees. 7. How will scaling affect Bitcoin privacy? Lastly, on-chain transactions are bad for privacy. Each centralized service in the Bitcoin ecosystem is a point of data that can connect an entire history of transactions and balances to their owners and associates. Many are not aware of this, but the company Chainalysis has partnered with the IRS to identify and connect all Bitcoin users with their addresses. The company claims to have reliable data on the owners of over 25% of all Bitcoin balances on the network. Along with a number of other companies like Jeff Garzik's Block, they are built upon selling the connections between Bitcoin balances and their real-world owners. The more on-chain transactions, the easier it is to establish these connections and the more information there is to sell. The fact that Garzik is the same person who has been one of the loudest voices in the Big Blocks Immediately campaign should throw some heavy salt on trusting his intentions. Off-chain and layered solutions offer far greater opportunities for privacy, which is critical to protecting innocent people from oppressive governments and centralized data collection. Bitcoin is a global decentralized currency. The only barometer for success is its security from the worst governments, not the best. Final thoughts. The bigger as needed block argument, by my consideration, tends to follow a strongest link holds the chain together mentality. As long as we get more users, a small hit to resiliency, number of nodes, speed of node deployment, network latency, minor decentralization, and bandwidth or storage costs to validate are all acceptable. Yet a hit to each of these characteristics, even a small one, could have not so insignificant consequences in the long term. A 10 megabyte block size today would barely graze the real scaling problem, but in 3 short years would have us securing a blockchain nearly 2 terabytes in size and growing at a far faster rate. However, the small block mentality recognizes that the weakest of any of these characteristics is the best possible measure of Bitcoin's security. Bitcoin must be secure in every way to be secure at all. I agree wholeheartedly that in general high fees are undesirable, but as a regular and long-time user of Bitcoin, I'm fully willing to pay higher fees to know with the highest certainty that Bitcoin remains the world's most secure and trustless monetary system. Too many underestimate the profound effect that even a small change in the foundations of an economy can have. Bitcoin has the potential to unlock a torrent of productivity and freedom for the entire world at a time when it is desperately needed. I'm not willing to risk losing that over a $2 transaction fee. So spin up that full node you've been procrastinating and join the revolution. So there you have it. That was my article, 7 Misunderstandings of Bitcoin's Scaling Problem. And I published this actually quite a while ago. Let's see. November 2nd, 2017. So this was shortly after the Bitcoin fork. There are some other topics I probably, if I was rewriting this article today, that I would have hit a little bit harder to make clearer. One thing I would have done is expanded a little bit, maybe with an analogy for the concept of the hard forkers kind of excusing security as the strongest chain holds everything together, whereas the small blockers are basically, and this is obviously a generalization, but it fits the mentality of the two different parties. But the small blockers are typically a, if there is a weak link anywhere, then the chain is not secure. There's no reason to, use it for whatever strength we're trying to get out of it. And a good analogy would be, let's imagine you're running or you're using a service. Say it's a messaging or social media service, something like that. And they've got all these awesome security features. You've got two-factor authentication. Everybody uses, by default, these like super long, 36-character random generated passwords. And the encryption on the back end is 1,028-bit RSA. And the servers are decentralized. They're spread out. It's like a federated system that's all over the world, and anybody can pop up a node, and it's all encrypted on those servers. And there's all these great aspects. It seems like an absolutely like solid brick of a system that just can't be broken into. But then there's a centralized company in the back that is able to revoke everybody's keys. And all you have to do is call up customer service and give your phone number and your name, and all your keys are revoked. All that other stuff is useless if there's a point of failure anywhere in there that wipes all of it out. Like, it's only as secure as your name and phone number. That's it. All the measurements and talk about 1,028 bits and how long it'll take to get into that, all of that's bullshit, because all you need is your name and phone number to get into the account and wipe everything, get all the information, break open your keys, access everything they want, take over your account, whatever it is. And in the sense of Bitcoin security, that's the same way. If nodes can't know what network they're trusting, like what network they're connecting to, if people aren't running their own nodes and actually auditing the blockchain, if I'm trusting a miner to audit this thing for me, then I'm as secure as that miner is. And I don't, why, the whole point of this is so that I'm not trusting somebody else. The idea that I'm running a node is that I am not trusting somebody else to validate any of this history, to validate anybody's ownership, and to validate any of the, just anything at all. Like, I'm validating all of it myself. Another good point that I think is Greg Maxwell. Yeah, it's Greg Maxwell said during the thousands of endless debates that he had on Reddit and Twitter about the block size, which I thought was an excellent point, is what happens when block size get just a little bit bigger. Now, block propagation, I read a lengthy analysis of how long it takes for blocks to get like spread throughout the network. I think it was they were saying when it reached a majority, but they were measuring somewhere between like 70 and 90% of the network receiving the blocks. And it could be, even with just, 1 megabyte blocks, it could be upwards of, 6 or 7 seconds to propagate through the whole network. Now, let's imagine we're looking at 4 or 5 megabyte blocks in that situation, and that gets up to like 20 or 30 seconds. That's not a small advantage to somebody who gets to mine 20 or 30 seconds ahead of somebody else. And those large institutional miners are going to have that advantage because they're going to have the best internet, the best hardware, and everything. And Greg Maxwell was talking about this in the sense that you're turning Bitcoin mining into a race. And Bitcoin mining is supposed to be a lottery. Doesn't matter where you are in the world, how big your computer is, or anything like that. Whatever your hash power is, that's your probability of winning the lottery ticket. So if you have 1/1000th of the hash power as somebody else, they are simply 1,000 times more likely to win the lottery. But you still have a chance of winning the lottery. If it's a race and not a lottery, and somebody is 30% faster than you, then they win every single time. There's no point in you even playing because it's a race. Bitcoin mining is supposed to be a lottery. Everyone is supposed to have an even playing field. And as soon as block propagation gets up into 30, I mean, there's 20, 30 seconds between blocks. Imagine if block propagation is 20 or 30 seconds across the network. And you're talking about it's not difficult to reach that, even with current infrastructure. It's not out of the question for a large block, say 10 megabytes, to take 30 seconds, maybe even upwards of a minute to reach 80-90% of the network. Lastly, it's important to be frank about what problem is being solved here. The Bitcoin network has to be resistant to governments, period. That's the goal here. It's supposed to be stateless money. If it's not stateless money, then it's worthless money. Which also essentially means if it can't work in the dark within a country's internet, then it won't survive the country deciding that people shouldn't be allowed to use it. If we can't propagate Bitcoin blocks and mine Bitcoin blocks and run nodes over the Tor network, under the most serious adversarial conditions in which we have to go completely dark, then it's not safe from the government. Just the notion that that's possible and the realization of that, because it's there and it always exists as essentially a backup plan, then any attacker is going to know that that would be an unsuccessful way to attack the network. As soon as we have 50 megabyte blocks or whatever it is, as soon as we're just increasing the block size and resource costs, well, then that becomes the easiest way to attack it. Because if you don't have a big bandwidth pipe access to keep the network in consensus, well, then the network falls apart. It splits into forks that are across different jurisdictions and different countries. It's no longer a global thing. Then we have Bitcoin US, Bitcoin China, Bitcoin Africa, whatever it is. So it has to be able to ride in the dark web, and we have to be able to have bandwidth constraints that are strong enough to work across all adversarial conditions in order to keep the network intact and keep consensus, even if a government decides that we're going to completely crack down on this thing and no one is allowed. It is illegal to run a node or send a Bitcoin transaction, period. Bitcoin could survive that as is. Or at least it's being engineered as if that's a possible scenario that it has to defend against. And the reason stateless money is the goal here is because the political manipulation and central control of monetary policy is one of the most extraordinarily destructive powers in human history. And almost every single government, every empire, falls victim to this exact problem. And the people don't have a way out. Historically, it's been gold or precious metals of some sort. But for the first time in history, we actually have the ability to build the foundations of a new economy that have private property and self-ownership and capital ownership of money at its actual core, at its foundation. Now, yes, international transfers are slow, they're expensive, all that great stuff. And Bitcoin and the crypto economy will very likely solve those problems in tandem with the far, far more historically significant problem of governments manipulating their currencies and forcing their people to pay for their own irresponsibilities. Hundreds of millions of people have starved to death throughout history. This goes back thousands of years. This is not a new problem. This has been a problem since money has existed. Governments have always seen it as the most critical power to hold. And particularly in the last 200 years, we've seen the centuries of central banking and the horrible consequences of their manipulation. Venezuela has caused a collapse in their currency so bad that the overwhelming majority of their population is now considered below the poverty line. They went from one of the wealthiest countries in their region, and actually they were hailed by Michael Moore as being a perfect show of what socialism is. Holy crap. And they have oil reserves that should make them extraordinarily wealthy, and yet they're now one of the poorest countries in their region. And last year, they completely ran out of toilet paper. The whole country, just out of toilet paper. People have lost their entire life savings. I just saw a video the other day of about 20 people climbing a fence into somebody else's farm to beat a cow to death so that they could rip it apart and take something home to eat. Understand, environmentalism and caring about poverty and candlelight vigils for, you know, the people on minimum wage. When people are starving, nobody gives two shits about any of that stuff. Complaining about those things are privileges of having a free economy that recognizes individual liberty and private property. If you don't have property and the assumption of self-ownership, well, then you don't have trade. And if you don't have trade, you don't have anything. Name me one thing in your house that you can make completely without needing to trade somebody else for it, or for a tool to make it. I'll give you the rest of the day to figure out what that is and tweet it to me. It's probably grow a tomato, which will take you how many months? And then that means that without trade, how would you even get a seed? I don't even know how you would get a seed for a tomato plant. You'd have to go digging through the woods to find a tomato plant. Holy crap. But that's probably all you got. That means that without trade, you would be naked in the woods, and in a couple of months, you'd have a tomato. And what's funny is that without trade, that's basically what society looks like. That's why socialism devolves into people breaking into a farm and beating a cow to death so that they have food. Because Venezuela no longer has a money that allows people to own capital that they made yesterday, because the government steals it from them overnight. This has nothing to do. Fees are way down the list. We'll get to fees. Fees will be solved. We are trying to secure money from the concept of political manipulation. Prioritizing low fees over the resistance to centralized control of the monetary policy is like worrying about fingerprints on a window of a skyscraper on the 93rd floor and ignoring the fact that the foundation is cracked in half and one side of it is sinking. A global, secure, stateless money could literally save millions of lives, tear down borders across the globe, end the idea of the political squabbling of tariffs and economic sanctions and all this idiocy where one tiny group of political people are pissed off at some other tiny group of political people, and the millions of people under either side is paying the price of their idiotic squabbles. It has the possibility of raising billions of people out of poverty just for the idea of them being able to hold capital outside of their state's permission to own it, which would create an explosion. And we've already seen this happening as globalization of the economic means and trade has increased. We've seen an absolute unprecedented explosion in wealth in the poorest nations across the planet. So in regards to the scaling debate, if somebody is telling you that we can get low fees and infinitely bigger blocks and all this good stuff, and they are not immediately addressing the consequences or the trade-offs that come with making those changes to the underlying network and what that could mean, how that could impact permissionless ownership and censorship resistant, you should be very, very wary of anything that they tell you after that. I'm not saying they're evil actors. I'm not saying anything like that at all. I don't think Roger Ver is a paid puppet or anything like that. I just think he's wrong, and I'm trying to give my opinion as to why. I just think we have very, very different priorities as to what Bitcoin means and what problem it's trying to solve. So in short, I just don't think we can separate the idea of censorship resistance and immutable money from the block size and scaling debate. I think they are absolutely 100% attached, like directly intertwined with each other and dependent on each other. So with that, we'll go ahead and just end this one here. I hope you guys enjoyed my article. Don't forget to follow me on Medium at The Crypto Economy, and then, of course, at Twitter, at The Crypto Economy as well, and subscribe on iTunes to stay up to date on these, and I'll have another article out for you tomorrow. Thanks, guys, for joining us. This has been a Crypto Economy Quick Read. Take it easy.